This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. How does living in a world filled with toxins combined with our genetic makeup and our personal behavior affect our health? What can cutting-edge medical technology tell us about our future health? In the future, will diagnoses and treatments be customized? Personalized? Those are some of the questions we'll take up this afternoon. Our guest is science journalist David Ewing Duncan. He's the author of Experimental Man, What One Man's Body Reveals About His Future, Your Health, and Our Toxic World. David Duncan is the experimental man of the title. For this exploration, he underwent all manner of medical tests. He may very well be the most tested healthy person in history. Listeners, you're invited to join us with your questions and comments. I look forward to your phone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. David Ewing Duncan is the director of the Center for Life Science Policy at UC Berkeley. He's also the chief correspondent for the public radio program Biotech Nation and a commentator for Morning Edition. You'll find his work in a number of other media, including Discover, Wired, National Geographic, and Harper's. His previous books include the bestseller Calendar. His new book, Experimental Man, is published by Wiley. And there's a website for the book with a wide variety of interactive features. Excuse me, I've got a little tickle here this afternoon. The website for the book, companion website, www.experimentalman.com. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. David Duncan, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
Glad to be here.
Good. So in all, how many tests did you undergo for this project?
Well, I was tested for literally thousands of different things in my body. It's split up into genes, environment, brain, and body. And worked with about 250 labs and companies and others to have these tests happen. So it's a lot.
Yeah. You want to give us a sense of some of the tests you underwent?
Sure. It's genes, and I had, literally thousands of genetic traits tested. And then in the environmental section, I had hundreds of environmental toxins that are inside of me and probably all of you as well. And then brain scans in the brain section, lots of different peeks into my mind for behavioral traits and to see if there are any diseases creeping up inside my head. And then the final section of the book is called Body, where I try to link all of this together into a single person to see if I can basically predict what might happen to me in the future. I'm a healthy person right now, as you said, and the real kind of issue here is what can we, meaning society and medical science, tell us about our future? And are we at a point with science and technology where we can begin to really truly predict what might happen down the line?
Hmm. One of the things you learned is that you have the caffeine fast metabolizer gene. What is that?
That's my favorite gene, actually. And as I'm sitting here drinking a cup of coffee right now, I always wondered why I could drink coffee all day long, full strength, and never really feel it, even right before I go to bed. And there are many of us out there, but there's a genetic variation, a mutation, if you will, that allows some people to basically drink or ingest caffeine, and it goes right through us. So, it never really causes all of the symptoms that other people feel. And I feel very blessed having that particular gene because I love coffee.
Yeah. I think that also says that we are so individual in our makeup.
Well, that's right. And that's what a lot of, the overarching term here that's being used for this kind of science and medicine is personalized health. And the personalized part is really critical because much of this is a reaction to a kind of one-size-fits-all type of medicine that's been really practiced for the last generation or so. You know, we're basically treated the same, and, you know, a good physician will begin to realize, okay, you're having side effects to that medication, let's try something else. But this is getting ahead of that. This is using science to actually figure out how we're different. And each of us, you know, we are different. And there's several million genetic markers out of the 3 billion genetic base pairs that are inside of each of our cells. There are a few million that make us different. And what we're trying to do, at least genetically, is analyze what these differences are and especially for health purposes, try to figure out, you know, what might be done differently. They're both medications, with you know, behavioral traits, with eating correctly. I mean, a lot of these have to do with diet, for instance. You know, some people, as we know, can basically pig out all day long and not gain weight, and others, they look at a cheeseburger and they put on 10 pounds. All of that, we know, makes us different, but now we're beginning to figure out why.
Yeah. There's a really interesting story, one of many in the book. There's an interesting story in the book about a woman who didn't have an enzyme that metabolizes codeine, and she was given the drug for pain, and it killed her. And now there's a genetic test that screens for such a problem, and you note that the test also predicts potential problems in a number of classes of drugs, including antidepressants, antipsychotics, beta blockers, pain medications, and some anti-cancer drugs. If you've ever had a bad reaction to a drug, you can see that this is something that could be really a very good thing. What does this test cost? Is it advisable, and for whom?
Well, the tests right now, you can actually buy them. Companies, they could call them direct-to-consumer companies. You can go online, and there are three or four major ones, 23andMe, Navigenics, DecodeMe. These are the names of some of these companies. And for anywhere, I think the cheapest one is around $400, and they will send you a little container where you spit into it, and you send your saliva back, and that's, you know, got cells that contain your DNA. They break those open, and they analyze. It's several hundred thousand to a million of your genetic markers, and they pull out of those genetic biomarkers that have some testing behind them, and so you end up getting several dozen results, basically, for different diseases. And so that's what you get, and what they'll do is, like, say for, you know, some form of cancer, or heart attack, or something like that, they'll give you a risk factor. So over the course of your lifetime, you might have a certain risk for these diseases based on your genes. And you asked about the accuracy. This is still very, very young science, and I write a lot about this in my journalism, that the science still, in some ways, in a broad sense, needs to catch up. You know, with the applicability in terms of being valid clinically. And what that means is that a lot of these tests still need to be really run through clinical trials like you would test a drug or something to make sure that they still work. So you're going to get kind of preliminary data in many cases.
Yeah. And how do people use this information? How do you tackle that question?
Yeah, that's the big question. And in fact, that's being studied. Me being a healthy person, I did this book partly to see how I would react, just, you know, using myself as a human guinea pig here, if you will. I also tested my parents, my brother, and my daughter, so we had the experimental family as well. And not surprisingly, since we're a pretty healthy family, you know, we came out largely okay. You know, fairly low risks. I did come up with some high-risk heart attack markers, and after many more extensive tests, believed that enough to, you know, slightly alter my diet. I mean, again, I was healthy, I was eating well. But that's really the big question here. In fact, even with existing technologies and preventive medicine, is trying to get patients to actually follow the prescriptions, you know, to eat right and exercise. And you know, almost every time I write about this, I get somebody commenting or calling or emailing saying, hey, you know, why do you need a fancy test to tell you what you already know anyway? And, there's some truth to that.
Yeah. Your younger brother, Don, has a genetic abnormality that makes his bones extremely vulnerable to stress. When and how did the family learn that it was genetic?
Well, we didn't even really understand that he had a disease. It's called osteogenesis imperfecta, and it's kind of commonly known as the brittle bone disease. And this really came out of nowhere in our family. We may have some indications of where it may have come from. There are genetic disorders that simply appear. You know, there's a mix-up of the genes, you know, with the mom and dad, and you have what's called de novo, or just a new genetic disorder. But we tested him and determined that there was some genetics behind it. But, you know, he's had this, and it's slowly been getting worse his whole life, and he's essentially disabled now with it. He's broken his bones so many times. And it slowly manifested over time. But we didn't really have any inkling. We probably should have, especially since I was a biotech reporter, you know, for several years. But it didn't occur to us in a very healthy family that we might have something like this going on. But now we're very aware of it.
Yeah. Would the information, had the family had it, been helpful when Don was a little boy?
Well, this is getting into some of the ethics of, mm-hmm. of genetics. I go back and forth on that in my, you know, talking to my family and my brother and my parents. My brother had a pretty normal life, you know, as the disease, got worse over time. But, you know, certainly growing up, although he was breaking bones a lot, we just thought he was accident prone. But he got to do, you know, all the normal things that people do, and the disease started getting much worse in his early 30s, and that's when it really began to constrict his ability to do things. But had we known, say when he was born, that he had a disorder like this, knowing my mother, I mean, she would have been incredibly protective of him, and he would not have been able to do a lot of those things that boys do, you know, sports and things. And it's an interesting question. I mean, on the other hand, it might have protected him from getting some of the injuries he got, which has made him disabled. So it's a tough question.
Yeah,
it's a
really interesting question. And so, in so many instances throughout this book, Experimental Man, there are trade-offs.
Yeah, and every time you get a new technology or a new science like this that begins to push its way into our lives, you know, you have these questions that come up like this, and these are questions. That's one of the reasons why I chose to have myself tested and my family rather than just simply write a third-person, normal, journalistic book about this, you know, to try to anticipate. But we'll all be facing these issues, and it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Hmm. In the beginning of the book, I'd like you to tell this story to our listeners, for our listeners. At the beginning of the book, you tell listeners a story that is about the fish gorge test. It's in the introduction. What did the fish gorge test involve, and what did it reveal?
Well, I actually start the book catching a fish off the coast of California where I live. And I caught a halibut, and then I went to a store and bought a swordfish steak. And this is to test levels of mercury inside of me. And the exposure to mercury for most people comes from eating large fish, because the mercury gets in the oceans. The smaller fish eat it, the bigger fish eat the smaller fish, and you've got an accumulation of larger quantities of mercury in these fish. So I took the halibut and I ate that for lunch, and I took the swordfish and ate it for dinner, and I did a before and after blood test of the mercury levels inside of me, and I went from 4 parts per billion, which is how you measure this, to 13 parts per billion just with those two meals. And the threshold for safety that the EPA suggests is around 5.8 parts per billion. So before the meals, I was below the threshold, and after the meals, I was quite a bit above. And that is really what this environmental testing is all about, and what the fish gorge experiment was. My doctor got upset with me for doing that. He said, you shouldn't do that. Although I pointed out to him it was only two meals of fish, and some people eat fish every meal.
Yeah, that's one of the questions that struck me is that, you know, does the amount of fish you consumed really amount to gorging?
Well, yeah, I would say with a little G. You know, to me, yeah, a gorge is a lot more than that. But, you know, all it took, and, you know, I want to emphasize before people say, you know, thinking, boy, I should stop eating fish. These are large fish, and the bigger the fish, the higher up on the food chain, as I said, the more mercury. Smaller fish have much less mercury, and, you know, it's very healthy to eat fish. But there are warnings even now from the FDA and EPA about, say, women of childbearing age eating a lot of large fish. But I took this one step further, by the way. Because I, in the book, I'm trying to link up genes, environment, brain, and body. And I tested myself genetically to see if I had any genes that made me sensitive to mercury. And if you read the book, I came out okay on that. I seem to have the normal variations of genes. And what these genes do is they help you get rid of the toxins like mercury. They flush them out of your body. Since then, though, I've actually discovered that I have a couple of genetic variations that do make me sensitive to mercury. So no more fish for me.
Not even little ones?
I'm okay with little ones. What I should say is no more big fish.
No more big fish.
Although, I you know, it's interesting that I don't really even like big fish. And it kind of makes you wonder if maybe your body just knows these things sometimes. Interesting.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, David Ewing Duncan, author most recently of Experimental Man, What One Man's Body Reveals About His Future, Your Health, and Our Toxic World. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our toxic world. We are swimming in this toxic world. You were tested for more than 300 chemicals. How many might you have been tested for?
Well, I was tested for 320 chemicals, and this was originally done for a National Geographic story about 3 years ago called The Pollution Within. And in the book, I expand on that story. But these are pesticides, dioxins, PCBs, ingredients in plastic like bisphenol A. So a whole broad range of chemicals. And these are some of the most common ones. So, and again, these are small, tiny little trace amounts like parts per billion or parts per trillion that showed up inside of me.
Yeah. Now, there was something that came as kind of a surprise, a flame retardant that was, you had quite a bit of it in you.
That was a surprise. You know, most of the chemicals, I came out fairly average levels, or I could explain why I might have slightly higher. But this one came out of nowhere. You know, we put flame retardants by law into virtually any product that can burn, and we do that because it saves lives. But like a lot of, you know, good ideas, there's a side effect to this one, and that is that some of these chemicals come loose and get in the air and attach to dust, and then we breathe them in. And I ended up with 12 times the normal levels of this particular class of flame retardants. And the only explanation that we could come up with was that it might be because I fly in airplanes a lot. And they're obviously full of flame retardants. And these are not levels, again, that are harmful necessarily, much higher levels. They're cancer-causing and thyroid disruptors and things like that, thyroid hormone disruptors. But that was a little startling.
Yeah. We've got a couple of listeners who would like to talk with you, so let's go and do that. Let's take a call from a listener now in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Thank you. Yeah, I have two basic questions for you. One, given your interest in individualizing medical treatment, I wonder if you're aware of or looked into traditional Chinese medicine and five-element theory or Indian traditional medicine, Ayurveda, which has a different but similar approach in terms of looking at, you know, the person is an individual and the type that they fit into or combination of types, and then how that would lead them to be more vulnerable to certain things and have more resistance to other things and give some kind of predictability about, you know, how they were going to develop in the future. And then also, given your interest in genetics, are you familiar with the burgeoning field of research called epigenetics and the significance that has for how we think about and look at our genetic heritage?
Well, the answer to the first question, I'm fascinated by traditional medicine and, you know, what we call alternative medicine in the West. In my very ambitious early phases of the book, I was hoping to include that, but I just basically, that's probably another book. But it should be a piece of all of this, because my sense is that, you know, having been a correspondent in Africa and traveled a lot and done many stories on traditional healing, it definitely is part of this equation. But this book is, I suppose, somewhat limited in that sense to the, you know, the Western technologies, although the whole idea of personalized health, I find a very intriguing aspect of that is, of course, turning us, using technology in a way to turn us back to a time when our Western medicine focused more specifically on individuals. So hopefully there's a convergence of all of this at some point. The second question on epigenetics, that is probably one of the most exciting elements of molecular biology that's happened in the last couple of years. And that suggests that DNA is not static. You know, you're not simply born with your DNA and you die with it and there's very little change. It suggests that your DNA is actually programmed to change itself in response to certain environmental inputs, like toxins. And it's in the early stages. And I mentioned it a couple times in the book, but when I was writing the book a couple years ago, you know, a year and a half ago, epigenetics was just really coming online. But I find that absolutely fascinating in a number of different ways, and certainly it's going to be a major focus of this interaction between the environment and genetics.
Well, another thing that it's been showing is that not only your physical environment has an influence over how your genes express themselves, but also your beliefs and thoughts, your emotions, can also affect the way the genes express themselves.
Well, that's, you know, it makes sense, and you know, all of this is related. There are a lot of mysteries about how behavior, you know, affects disease, and you know how people, you know, what people have inherited. You know, we know families that are optimistic or pessimistic, and that can have a great deal to do with their survivability and disease. So I think we're just beginning to explore a vast new continent. Now that's going to, like I said, I mean, one of the things that I'm really pushing as I'm talking about the book is this idea of linkage, of linking together a lot of these different disciplines and ways of thinking. And I think it's really time we do that. We tend to be so atomized in this, in our society, with specialists and the silo effect. And all of this needs to be studied and linked, in my view anyway.
Yeah. Just to follow up before I go to the next caller, to follow up here, what can you tell us about stress and how all these things come together?
Well, stress has an enormous impact on your body, you know, as we know. I mean, you don't need a fancy test to tell you that. I didn't specifically test myself in the book for that. Again, I had to kind of limit it, or would have been a multi-volume book. But one of the intriguing things it does is it apparently hastens the shrinking of your brain, which, if you read the book, I was rather startled to find that my brain is shrinking anyway, and all of our brains are as we get older. But stress, apparently, and heavy drinking both shrink your brain. So that's one thing it does. It does much more. But you know, it's definitely an environmental impact we all have to deal with.
And in a moment or two, maybe we can come back and talk about the incredible shrinking brain. But let's take another call. On line two, a listener is waiting for us on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Hi. I just have a fish question about the fish. I assume tuna, since it's a large fish, would be included in the mercury problem. Hello?
What's that? I'm sorry. Could you repeat that again?
I assume tuna, because it's in the large ocean fish category, would be a mercury conduit, so to speak.
Well, tuna is a tough one because the different size tunas. Age is an impact as well on this. So the older the fish and the higher up on the food chain. And my understanding is, having talked to the people that know about this, is a lot of the like canned tuna and tuna fish sandwich or tunas and tuna fish sandwiches are usually smaller, younger fish. And in fact, the stuff you pay a lot of money for in a fancy restaurant tend to be the older fish, so they may have a higher mercury content. So, you know, the one fish I actually, or the one fishy sort of thing I do like to eat is a tuna fish salad sandwich. I was kind of hoping that maybe I could still eat that. So that's what I was told. It's certainly if you're eating the steak version of a tuna, you know, a large tuna, that's going to be right there in that category. That goes for some of the other fish too. You know, if they're smaller or younger fish, they'll have less mercury.
I see. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Other calls, questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, David Ewing Duncan, author of Experimental Man, What One Man's Body Reveals About His Future, Your Health, and Our Toxic World. There's a lot of interest in the brain and what we call now brain age. What can you tell us about that? What have you learned about how we might keep our brains from shrinking?
Well, the first thing I was doing in the book was trying to determine, you know, what was going on in my brain, and then hopefully come up with some methods to keep it younger and nimbler. And by the way, there is on experimentalman.com, the listeners can go and take a brain age test, which is a test that's used by companies that are running FDA trials on drugs for the brain. And it's a shorter version than what they do in the actual trials. But you will get a brain age, and it could be younger than your actual age or older. And it tests things like memory and cognition. And I found this to be, out of all of the things tested in the book, it was the most mysterious and probably personal test, because, you know, our brains are us. It's who we are, our personalities. We all know our strengths and weaknesses, or at least hopefully we know something about that. We inhabit our brains, you know, if you will. And you never quite know with a lot of these scanning technologies, which is mostly what I use to test myself, like MRI scans, you never quite know what's going to be revealed. And so in a way, that made me even kind of more anxious than the genetic testing and some of the other tests.
Yeah. You spent 22 hours in an MRI.
22 long hours.
Yeah.
You're laying on your back, you know, you're in this big donut thing, you know, it looks like a giant donut, and you're stuck in the middle of it. And it's a very kind of crude way of testing the brain. I mean, in a way, at least for me, they were partly testing on how well I could stay awake. Because when I lay down on my back and they have a blanket over you, and you know, you feel like going to sleep. But they tested me for what's called functional MRI scans, and these are looking to see when they stimulate you in some way. They show you a picture or something, ask you a question. It elicits a certain blood flow to different parts of your brain, you know, like your emotional parts of your brain or your frontal cortex, your rational part. So they tested me for things like greed and altruism and belief and lots of other tests of that sort to see how I compare to other people.
Yeah. A cup of coffee wouldn't have helped you in there.
I tried that. That's one case where I wish I had not had the caffeine fast metabolizer gene.
So the 22 hours, was that all straight?
Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, my God. No, that would have killed.
You would have been out, yeah.
Yeah. No, I did do a battery of tests at New York University in New York City. It was two sessions a day of 2 hours each in the MRI for 3 days. So that was pretty intense. And they called me about halfway through and said that I was a terrible subject because I kept wiggling.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to stay awake, but you can't wiggle because your brain wiggles, and then that makes the images blurry. So I promise not to wiggle, and I think I guess I did okay.
Yeah. Well, what, you know, as you mentioned, that this is kind of maybe the most revealing kind of testing that you went through. What did it reveal about you?
Well, I kind of somewhat surprisingly, I came out fairly normal. Some of my friends might wonder if that's really accurate, but I found out. I'll tell you about one test, which was kind of intriguing. There's a whole area of neuroscience now called neuroeconomics, and it's economists connecting up with neuroscientists to basically try to figure out how the brain makes decisions. And I think given our economy and the crash of the markets and all that, we would probably like to know the answer to that, at least for people who operate in the markets. But one aspect of neuroeconomics is neuromarketing. And marketing companies are beginning to show people products while they're being scanned to see what their brain likes, mm-hmm. as opposed to what they may like or say they like, because that can be different. And I had one test where my brain outed me, where I was shown a poster for the movie Pan's Labyrinth, which is a kind of dark art movie. And because I've been involved with film, you know, and consider myself a sort of pseudo-intellectual film type person, I put down that I love this product. I love this movie. And unfortunately, my brain did not agree with me.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, my brain liked Dodgeball, the movie. And that was sort of embarrassing. But I was shown a number of other products. Unfortunately, my brain also seemed to like Beethoven and a couple of other more intellectual products. So that was reassuring. But that was kind of a fun one. Another one was anxiety. I was tested to see if I get anxious in the normal way when confronted with an anxious situation and then can modulate my brain to settle myself down, and I came out okay on that. But anxiety runs in a small way through my family, and I was a little worried that I might come out on the worst end of things there, but came out okay.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me of a story you tell in the introduction where you're introducing readers to yourself, and you say that, you know, you at one point in your life you could get very, very anxious before anything you had to do publicly. You were worried that you weren't going to perform and people might not think the best of you. They might think you were an idiot. But then over time, somehow or other, you found some kind of way to compensate. And then you were able to do, look at all the things that you've done.
Well, that's right. Like I said, my mother gets anxious and her mother got anxious. And it's not at probably the stage of being a disorder, but it's been significant at times, and I was very shy. I mean, I was a sort of introvert-extrovert when I was younger, sort of both. And in a way, the extrovert ended up winning out mostly. But that's the point of some of these tests I was taking. Most of the anxiety tests I took were at Stanford University, and psychiatrists there are trying to figure out how to help patients with anxiety disorders learn to modulate them or slow them down or shut them down, which healthy brains can do. And the test they ran, one of them was they showed me a picture of a roaring lion, but it was subliminal. It was flashed in front of my face. I didn't actually consciously see it, but my brain did and reacted with the fight or flight parts of the brain. And then they quickly showed an image of a field of daisies, you know, a very calm image. And you can see in a series of pictures of my brain, the brain basically telling itself to settle down. You know, the frontal lobe, the rational part saying, it's just daisies, don't worry, it's not, you know, nothing to worry about. And you can see that process, and that was a normal, healthy process. People who have anxiety disorders, though, can't do that as well. And so these psychiatrists, I didn't take the second part of the test, which is they are actually working with both healthy volunteers and people with anxiety disorders, and they're trying different methods like psychotherapy and meditation and other methods to see if they can train these people to shut down these, you know, this general anxiety like this. So it's one of the marvelous things about our brain. You know, we can get it to adapt over time.
You mentioned neuromarketing. I think this is really fascinating. Some time ago, I talked with a fellow who's interested in the same field, neuromarketing, and he actually did MRIs, or I can't remember now exactly what he was involved with. But anyway, one of the things that they did was they showed smokers in the MRI packages of cigarettes, the warning on the package of cigarettes. And it actually stimulated them. They might have said, no, that would tell me not to smoke. But instead, it fired them up to smoke.
I haven't heard about that one. That's, you know, that's fascinating. It must be some sort of strange association that the brain has. You know, kind of, maybe that has something to do with why for years people who smoke read those warnings and smoke anyway. So, yeah, I mean, you know, these MRI scans, much like some of the other testing I've described, are in very early stages, and mostly they've been tests run on very small numbers of people. You know, the larger the populations, the more you understand these traits. But it is fascinating, and again, in the interest of linkage here, there will come a time when, you know, we are all of these different tools, the MRI scans, anything that's not harmful, as MRI scans are not harmful, genetic tests, environmental tests, I think we'll all be linked together, and, you know, we'll be able to get a rather profound image of ourselves and who we are. And I guess the question is, A, will we believe it? B, will we act on it? And C, will it absolutely freak us out?
And who will pay for it?
Well, that's another issue. And you know, I have a little program at Berkeley called the Center for Life Science Policy. These are some of the things we're looking into: is can you make a cost-benefit argument in favor of some of these predictive tests that might allow you to allow someone to prevent having a disease? Does it make sense to pay, you know, couple hundred dollars or a few hundred dollars for a test up front that might save a lot of money down the line? Our health system, unfortunately, doesn't think that way at the moment, and that's why a lot of preventive medicine doesn't happen. But I think there's a case to be made that we could not only be healthier with some of these tools, but also to save money.
Yeah. In the segment of the book, in the section of the book about chemicals, you talk about risk assessment, and it's been done historically as it pertains to populations. Could this kind of testing that we're talking about today, this kind of personal medicine, could you do it more broadly in terms of populations, or does that just cut away the value of it totally?
Well, that's actually what most of the information is right now, is population data. Most of the genetic data collected now comes from population studies, and you're taking, say, 10,000 people, and you're testing those who have had, say, a heart attack and those who have not, and you're comparing them genetically and finding out that the people who have had a heart attack have a different variation on, you know, one or more genes, and that statistically may account for, you know, this heart attack. And those who carry that and have not had a heart attack then have a higher risk factor. And that's all, almost all population-based at the moment. In fact, that's a problem because a lot of that data is being used to try to predict an individual's risk factor, when in fact it really just tells you as an individual where you stand with the population. And I hope that makes sense. That's what I was saying earlier in our conversation, that a lot of this data needs to be validated. You need to run tests to see if these are accurate predictors, these population statistics, if they actually do apply to predicting a risk factor for an individual.
Mm. You know, the subtitle of the book is Our Toxic World, and we're in the midst of this toxic stuff, and we can't see it or smell it. And given all the variations, my stew and yours might be very different, is very different. What do we know about the effect that pollution is having on us? And, you know, since the 1960s, we've had laws that prohibit or limit pollution. Where are we today?
Well, it's sort of the best of times and worst of times, if you'll use the Charles Dickens Tale of Two Cities beginning. The plus side is that in my lifetime, I'm 51 years old, when I was a kid growing up outside of Kansas City in the Midwest, the air and the water were basically toxic, certainly compared to today. And we had the Clean Air and Clean Water Act in the 70s and the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. And it does give you some hope, you know, that democracy can overcome some of these problems. And, you know, places that you couldn't even stick your hand in, ponds and rivers and things when I was growing up, now are clean and have fish in them and are fine. On the other hand, these chemicals are still pervasive. They're everywhere. And some other developing countries don't have Clean Air and Clean Water Acts, for instance, and we're still putting out a lot of chemicals and pollutants that don't show up, say, in the density of the atmosphere. And, you know, like flame retardants, for instance, they're invisible. Mm. They might get inside of you. So they're still there. And the big question for me with all of this, and I think anyone that's been tested or thinks about this, is what do these tiny little amounts that get inside of people really mean? Are they harmless? Like, you know, some chemical industry basically says there's no evidence that they are harmful, but of course there's no evidence that they're not. And we're obviously not dropping dead in the streets, you know, with parts per billion of a flame retardant inside of us, but the long-term damage is unknown.
Yeah. Well, we can do things. We can do things like stop eating big fish or eat them very rarely, but there's not much we can do about so many things that are in the environment.
Well, that's right. And I picked mercury partly because there's a lot of data on it, unlike most chemicals that have not really been tested much at all at these small levels, and also because you can do something about it. You can just simply stop eating fish. Most of the chemicals, though, you're going to get small trace amounts inside of you, whether you like it or not. And, you know, I think there should be an imperative to be researching and testing this. And there are some technologies that are beginning to come online that may allow us to do that. I mean, part of the problem is there's obviously an ethical taboo to testing toxicity in humans, because the way you test toxicity is you have an organism, you expose it to higher and higher levels of a chemical until you kill it. And we're obviously not going to do that to establish thresholds and understand what happens in humans. So we have to be a little more clever in how we do it. But there's some interesting technologies being developed that are doing that.
Mm. There, we'll have to leave it. We're out of time. David Duncan, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
David Ewing Duncan is the author of Experimental Man, What One Man's Body Reveals About His Future, Your Health, and Our Toxic World. There is a companion website for the book, www.experimentalman.com. Nature.com. An Experimental Man is published by Wiley.